Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, broadcast and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball, capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. And Larry Gallo were some pretty bad hombres. So bad, even most of the mafia wanted nothing to do with them in New York in the 1960s and 1970s. Murder, extortion, armed robbery, all in a day's work for these guys. But if they were so bad, why do so many literary types come to admire them, especially Joey? Bob Dylan, for example, early in his career, thought of Crazy Joey Gallo as more folk hero than outlaw. And I've now read Tom Folsom's rich, colorful history of the Gallo brothers, the mad ones. But I'll be honest, I still don't entirely get their appeal. Hopefully, the author can clear up the mystery. Tom Folsom, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Hey, welcome to the show. So I'm through the book and, fascinating stuff, but I don't get it. Why was some of the literati of the time so drawn to the Gallos? What is it about them?
Well, Joey Gallo was certainly not your typical gangster. I mean, most gangsters aren't able to quote Camus and Sartre and speak on existential philosophy as well as they can talk about shaking down an extortion victim. So to me, you have to realize that, when Joey's coming out of prison, this is probably around 1972, he's coming right at the cusp of The Godfather, which is a phenomenon in New York and all across the country. And, I think a lot of these kind of high society types are they just watch this fantastic movie, The Godfather, and you see the three Corleone boys, Michael and Sonny and Fredo, and, they don't seem like such bad guys. And, I think that the Godfather kind of paints an inaccurate portrait of what the mob is, very much romanticizes it. And so, I think people are watching this movie and they're saying, well, the mafia isn't so bad. They're just on the outs of society and they've been shut up by America. And I think, given the fervor of this, I think everybody who was anybody, as one person said, wanted to meet a real life mobster. And so here comes Joey Gallo onto the scene, and he's friends with Jerry Orbach, and Jerry, of course, played Joey Gallo in the gang that couldn't shoot straight in a character named Kid Sally Palumbo. So you got a guy like Jerry Orbach making the introduction to the high society, and they look at Joey and they see this, charismatic, gangster, and they think everything is just charming and wonderful until, a couple weeks later when he gets whacked outside of Umberto's clan house in Little Italy.
Now, did the same thing happen with The Sopranos? Did that show on HBO make it acceptable to say, hey, the mobsters, they're not so bad, so what if they kill people and extort money and do all those other kind of things? They're kind of cool, they're on TV.
Well, I think at this point we're a little more media savvy perhaps than at least media savvy in terms of thinking about organized crime than it was in the 1970s. I mean, I think that for so much of the 50s, the mob was really shrouded in mystery, and you have these Senate hearings about them, and people really didn't know that much about the mob. And so when The Godfather comes out, I mean, this is stuff, that people would have been killed for knowing 10 years earlier, I'd say. But, he kind of, Mario Puzo, half invented and half drew from some of the experiences that actually were from the Gallo brothers, one of which was going to the mattresses and sleeps with fishes. I mean, these are stories that came straight from the Gallo brothers' story. So given that, I think that, again, this is very much, Puzo's portrayal of this new and fascinating world. And again, it's this phenomenon and people were really swept up by it. And I think, and Joey definitely coasted that sort of mobster frenzy. I think one socialite called it gangster chic.
Mm-hmm. Now, did Joey want these, celebrity and society friends, or did he just,
Well, he definitely did. I think that, You know, most smart mobsters are the ones who want to stay in the rackets for, you know, for a good amount of time. They stay behind the scenes. Once you really start exposing yourself to the media, become a character like a John Gotti, for instance, well, then you're just going to be on the top of the Fed's list to take down. So, you know, Joey, you know, this happened again in the 60s, in the early 60s. He was all over, you know, he would hold impromptu press conferences. You know, he even invited, you know, Life magazine to come into Gallo headquarters on President Street on the waterfront in Brooklyn and take photographs of the Gallo gang. This is unheard of when you're talking about, you know, a mafia with codes of omerta and shrouded in secrecy.
Now, I get that he was media savvy and that he read a good deal, but, you know, I can't say that he comes off as terribly bright in the book. I mean, reading the books, you know, reading Camus and Sartre, and I mean, the idea, I think, in most people's mind is that it's enlightening and it opens your mind to things, but it doesn't seem to have worked that way for Joey, except in that as word gets around that he's read these books and, you know, you have him in his notebooks writing things down that he sees in these books, it doesn't really seem to have affected him the same way.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's a guy like Joey, he's going to take what he learns, you know, from both the coffee shops of Greenwich Village where he liked to hang out in the early 60s and, you know, when he's in prison during the 1960s, during the rise of black nationalism, you know, the prison's a real hotbed for this, the prison system. And so Joey's taking what he's learning and he's twisting it to his own means. And what Joey would do is he would, you know, he decided that, well, I'm going to start creating alliances with guys like Nicky Barnes, who was the person I wrote my last book with, Mr. Untouchable, who was an infamous Harlem heroin dealer, portrayed an American gangster by Cuba Gooding Jr. You know, these aren't necessarily socially acceptable ideas, you know, making alliances, you know, to rule the heroin trade of New York City. But for the mafia, these were actually quite revolutionary ideas that Joey's bringing forth.
But if Joey is smart enough to seek out these alliances with a Nicky Barnes after the commission said no, we're not doing drugs, you know, and then they push that out to the margins, so to speak, and you know, they start Gallows or whomever dealing drugs through surrogates like a Nicky Barnes maybe or others. But if Joey is smart enough to cultivate the press, to cultivate black militants or just people outside of the basic Italian family, why wasn't he smart enough to improve his position within organized crime and find a better place for himself? I mean, it seems like, you know, from the day we're introduced to him, he's at odds with the very people he should be, you know, if we would call it now, networking with.
Well, very much. I mean, well, this is, you know, this is, to me, the mafia in the 50s was you could think of it as a corporation to rival IBM. I mean, even Robert Kennedy had said, you know, organized crime is the greatest threat on American soil. The mob was serious business in the 50s. So I feel that, you know, Joey's looking at this, and basically for a guy to move up the ranks, he's got to, you know, he's got to start in the mailroom, then he's got to make his way up the corporate ladder of the mafia, up the ladder of Murder, Inc., almost, as you can put it in corporate terms. So Joey didn't have the patience for that. You know, I think a lot of people when you're thinking about the late 50s, early 60s, especially in a place like Greenwich Village, you know, they don't want to be – they don't want to follow the traditional rules of the establishment. They want to forge their own paths and blaze their own trails. And I, you know, ultimately it didn't work. You know, this, and I think this could have been, you know, one of the lessons learned of the 60s. But, you know, Joey, he was caught up in that spirit, and you know, 10 years later, he ended up getting gunned down in the clam house.
Right back where he started, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, Joey's nickname was Crazy Joey Gallo. Was he crazy?
Well, it's tough to say. You know, the police, whenever, you know, his psychiatric files say that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. And, you know, I think our understanding of mental illness has definitely progressed since then. I think he definitely played the crazy card to his advantage in terms of, you know, his favorite character in the movies, you know, Joey's a big fan of B-movies, and he liked one in particular, a guy named Richard Widmark, who played Tommy Udo. Tommy Udo was this psychopathic, wisecracking killer in Kiss of Death, and, you know, he really terrified the audiences by doing things like pushing an old lady in a wheelchair down the steps. You know, and now we can almost think of it as almost a guy like the Joker in Batman. But Joey looks at a guy like that, and he's, you know, this is, he's using terror and the ability to inflict fear in people by being a psychotic. This is kind of his, this is a persona that he cultivates. And hence, he wanted people to know the name Crazy Joe, and he would actually call reporters when they didn't print his nickname in the papers.
It is a bit of a contradiction, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what about Larry? Joey gets all the ink. What's the difference between Larry and Joey's in terms of the way they operated?
Well, I think, you know, Joey was the spark plug of the Gallo gang, but Larry was the boss. Actually, his nickname was Larry the Boss. And apparently, you know, he was a very kind of quiet figure. He would do things like he would, you know, in the middle when the Gallo brothers were going to the mattresses, meaning that they would all hold up Alamo style in this tenement and with a bunch of shotguns and you know, hide out from the enemy. He would do things like he would pick up his violin and he would play Verdi. Verdi was a very enigmatic character, but he was apparently really the brains of the Gallo family, you know, business. And as one detective who knew him put it to me, he said, "Well, Larry Gallo's a genius. He could take your watch apart." So, you know, Larry was the guy who, he could always control Joey, though. That was one thing about, you know, Larry was the older brother, and as the older brother, you know, he was responsible, I'd say, for the Gallo family mantle.
Hmm. Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to call in. We've got a new web chat system, and I hadn't looked at it in a moment, and I see there's a whole bunch of people who would like to call in. So if you want to give us a call, 646-595-3135. You can talk to Tom Folsom about his new book, The Mad Ones, and I'll caution you to do it only if you're listening to us live, which is Friday, May 22nd, 2009. If you're listening to us on tape, you can call, but we won't answer. Now, there's a third brother involved. Now, forgot to say. Kid Blast. He never rose even as high as Larry and Joe did.
No, he was the kind of the quintessential little brother, I'd say, of the Gallo gang.
They didn't misunderstood, underappreciated, or just
He was the one where, you know, once Joey got gunned down, you know, Kid Blast was kind of responsible for the future of the Gallo gang and to see where he would take him. I mean, I think the papers, you know, put that a guy like Kid Blast was. You know, some people thought he was, you know, he had the best of both brothers, you might say, you know, kind of the Larry's brains and I think Joey's kind of charisma, if you talk about it in those terms. But, you know, he was kind of in charge of the Gallo gang until this entire Gallo war, I'd say, kind of slowly petered out over the course of the 70s. And, you know, by that time they kept fighting so much, I think the five families were, you know, willing to give the Gallos whatever they wanted because they'd been so sick of, you know, having to fight these troublesome Gallo boys for the, you know, boys for the past two decades.
Interesting. Well, let's go to the phones. Hi, do you have a comment or question for Tom Folsom?
Yes, Tom. I want to tell you, I didn't get to read your book yet. How new is the book?
It's about 2 weeks old.
Oh, okay, great. I'm definitely going to get it. Do Borgers carry it?
Sure, absolutely.
Great. I love books like that. You know, when I was in a joint, the only books I read was like, I read Gotti's thing, and, you know, I just read all kind of mob books all the time. I've always been infatuated with it, only because my line of work dealt with it a little bit. And I touched the edge of it in the business I was in. I was in a vending business, and you kind of can't help touching the outer skirts of that, you know.
Well, sure. No, the Gallos actually they owned the direct vending machine company. Machines were that was their bread and butter.
Sure, I was in a poker machine business and pool tables, jukeboxes, and stuff like that. I did it for 30 years, and but I want to talk about you. We're not here to talk about me. One of my questions is, what the Gallo gang. How old is the this information that you got from this? How old is the information in this book?
Well, you know, a lot of the information was recently released. You know, I got them released through FOIA, about 15,000 pages, or 1,500 pages, rather, of FBI files in the Gallo
right,
brothers.
So you got 302s, and you got stuff like crime commission reports and different things
absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely, and it was interesting when you're looking at these files. I mean, you know, the FBI, you know, they would watch the Gallos about 24-7 over a course of, you know, I'd say about 2 years in the early 60s. And the Gallo brothers were, you know, they were the low men on the mafia totem pole. And, you know, but the FBI, they established a relationship. I'm not saying the Gallos were squealing or anything, but they, you know, kind of hung around enough and they'd hear talk. But, you know, I think the FBI got a more complete picture of what the Cosa Nostra bat was about just by spending day in and day out with the Gallo brothers and learning information from the bottom up than I think that they had from any other source until that time.
Right. Well, the Gallo brothers were a little bit. They flaunted it like Gotti flaunted it.
Absolutely.
And for some reason, you know, the Italian mafia, and I know you got different type. I'm just using the word mafia as family. Okay. I'm not really stereotyping any particular nationality, but you know, you have the Irish Westies. You know, you have different groups like that, and the Italian mobsters, for some reason. What I got out of it, they're always the ones that would squeal on everybody. They'd squeal on their own parents if they got in trouble. And I was just kind of wondering why. Why did that characteristic always hit them when they were supposed to be such tough guys?
I'm not sure if I could answer, you know, that question, honestly.
Well, I mean, I don't mean it in a derogatory way. I'm just asking you is, you know, it didn't involve any Irish people or anything. It was mostly Italian. The book you write is mostly Italians, right? And their lifestyles and everything. Am I correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so it didn't get in. Your book didn't get into any other type of mob. Did they have any mob relations with any other organizations, like the Irish Mafia or Polish Mafia or whatever?
No, you know, but the Gallos did. You know, you could call them many things, but one thing is that they weren't necessarily prejudiced. I mean, they would have. They were kind of known as the international gang, the outlaw gang among members of the five families. You know, they had guys like they had an Egyptian hitman named Ali Baba, who was a, you know, and they'd have some Syrian tough guys. I think Louis the Syrian was one of them. So they kind of cultivated a lot. You know, it wasn't just exclusively Italian or Sicilian. And this was this kind of got the Gallos a reputation as outlaws.
Right. Did your book goes back as far as the 1960s with them?
Yeah, it begins around 1957 through Joey's death in 72.
Did it have anything in there about like the Kennedy assassination and the mob and that?
Well, you know,
did you touch any there?
Oh, one report that I read was quite interesting. It was they were basically saying that, well, there's no way that the mafia could have been involved in the Kennedy assassination because the Gallo brothers had thrown the five families into such upheaval with their revolt that the mafia was too busy dealing with the Gallos to even deal with the Kennedys.
Now, were the Gallos at the Appalachian meeting?
No.
Okay, they weren't there. So they kind of preceded that or postceded that, I mean?
Yes, they came after.
Okay, and do you interact with John Gotti, the Gambino family at all?
No.
Separate family, huh?
80s.
Two separate family. Then they came. They were ones before the Gambinos, then, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate the answers there, and good luck with your thing. And do I smell a movie here soon, or?
Yes, the film rights have been bought by the Weinstein Company, so we're looking forward to that.
Great, fantastic. Well, my kind of movies, guy. You know, there's no Sopranos on, so you got to fill that need you got inside for that mobster stuff. You know, us all the wannabes. You know, you got to get that taste of it. You know, so good luck with everything, and I'm looking forward to reading the book, and I'll get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty.
Thanks for your call.
Sure, Mr. Media.
Tom, are there? I mean, this guy is talking about being on the fringes of all that kind of stuff in the vending machine business. Are you finding a lot of people want to talk to you in the same manner because, you know, they've been close to it or they have a fascination with it? Or
Well, I try to have been keeping a professional distance, let's say.
Well, I mean, one of the things I wondered about is the research. You talk at the beginning of the book about the sources of the book. I'm not sure if I missed this, but did you actually interview any mobsters, anyone, you know, with those connections, or did you rely primarily on FBI files and transcripts of wiretaps and
I spoke with Nicky Barnes, who was he played a key role in the story, and he and Joey, you know, forged this friendship in 60s prisons. I also talked to, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, the FBI guys and the detectives who were following the Gallo brothers, you know, they were basically living there on President Street where the Gallos were holed up and going to the mattresses, you know, in the early 60s and the late 70s. And, you know, they had relationships with them. They you know, they would even sit down and have dinner with the guys, you know. So this is part of the nature is that you got a really good sense of the atmosphere and the flavor of what these guys were about just talking to the NYPD detectives and FBI men who were just going in there day in and day out as a part of their job.
Well, reading the book when the FBI comes in and settles in on President Street to try to prevent the bloodshed, you kind of suspect that it's leading to the point where the FBI becomes, I don't want to say enamored, but they no longer see these guys as aliens. They see them as people. They see them interact with their kids.
True, but at the same time, they don't, you know, they've got a job to do. And, you know, the guys in the FBI, you know, sometimes when you're, you know, kind of the friendlier you are, the more that, you know, they may kind of slip up on the other end and tell you something or give you a little tidbit here. And you report that, that goes straight to J. Edgar Hoover, you know, and through forging these relationships, you know, they were able to get a wealth of information that would not have been available to them otherwise.
Mm-hmm. There was that plot line in The Sopranos near the end where the FBI agent who's following them and always got his eye on them is always parked outside of the butcher shop, eventually comes and talks to them and tips Tony and his crew off that someone's out to get him, and you know, he becomes more protective of Tony than coming after Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get a sense from, you know, talking to these detectives that they actually built some
No, they always had their eye on the job.
Okay.
You know, yeah, you can certainly be friendly with these guys. You can certainly, you know, milk them for information. But at the end of the day, you know, they were very clear about the job that they had to do.
Now, you have some incredible detail. I want to ask you about this. I know you say up front that none of this has been recreated. That it's so. Tell me about this. I mean, you describe on page 83, for example. This is where Larry gets nearly strangled. Pretty close to, I mean, you know, you get to the end of the section, you think he has been. You say, hands emerged from the dark glass out of nowhere. Larry saw the reflection of a manila cord as it looped around his neck and pulled tight. He scratched at it, but his fingertips slid off. The rope twisted tighter, expertly pulled at the knotted ends. The gara, I never know if I'm saying that right, ripped back and forth across Larry's neck, sawing into his flesh, slow and methodical. Larry fell off the stool onto the floor. Always neat as a pin, he hated that everything spilled from his bowels. His heart stopped. How do you get that kind of detail? I mean, there was only two people there, and one of them, you know, was probably never found.
Well, they've got, you know, there was a large inquiry into that event. I mean, they were ultimately never able to convict anybody in that strangling of Larry, because Larry he refused to identify his own killers, or would-be killers, rather. This was part of the mafia code. But there were months and months of police investigations into this, and the fruits of those investigations were made public.
But I mean, this kind of detail, the only person who could provide that kind of detail would be Larry.
Well, they've also got the bartender there, you know, you know, who knows what went behind closed doors in terms of, you know, what went behind the NYPD, what they would go on the record about, what they wouldn't. You know, I'm looking at what, you know, the NYPD came up with in the course of this case, and you can take their details of when, where they got it from. Who knows what kind of deals they made, but, you know, ultimately no one would stand before a jury and make these kind of accusations, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't information there.
What about this one, page 61? I mean, and this is fascinating reading, but I mean, to be honest, and I mean no disrespect whatsoever, Tom, it reads more like fiction than nonfiction. I mean, you have a conversation here with Joey and Jeffy, who's, I'm not sure if they were married at that point or if that came later, but they're, I think they're in the car. You say sweat bubbled up on Joey's brow. They're driving, blah, 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 blah. And then if anything happens to me, said Joey, I want you to go with my mother, with the kid. I'm not having a kid for your mother, said Jeffy. If you want your mother to raise a kid, go fuck your mother. How do you get, I mean, dialogue like that? With
Jeffy.
Jeffy,
this is from Jeffy.
Did you talk to her, or was she?
She passed away before the project began, but she'd given interviews about this in other sources.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I have to ask. It's like I said. It reads like great fiction, and it's very colorful, but it's so detailed. And there's only Joey and Jeffy in the car, so.
Well, if you take a look at the back of the bibliography, you cull these details from countless sources. And,
right.
You know, one thing that the Gallows weren't was press shy. They were featured in the Saturday Evening Post. They were featured in a spread in Life magazine, you know, for instance, as well as daily FBI files that are coming in, you know, from the FBI to straight to Hoover.
Right, but in the 60s and early 70s, no one was printing lines like, you know, if you want a baby, for your, you know, you go fuck your mother. So,
but this is, you know, these things are after the fact.
Okay.
And people reminisce.
All right. And did your research give you any pause to think of the Gallows as misunderstood?
I think that I think the Gallows probably presented themselves exactly as they, you know, wanted to be portrayed. You know, I think that this idea that they became cultural icons says as much about America's fascination with gangsters and mythologizing of gangsters as it does about the Gallows themselves. The fact that you have someone saying, you know, like a cultural luminary, like Susan Sontag saying, you know, I wish I met Joe Gallo before, you know, he died. You know, that to me is reason enough, let alone the reason that a guy like Bob Dylan writes a song about a guy like Joey Gallo. You know, why is this happening? To me, that's a fascinating place to look.
Yeah, I mean, stuff like that just makes me think that, you know, even the literati are flawed. Although, you know, it's interesting that that Dylan, the same guy who writes a song about Gallo, wrote, you know, took up the defense of Reuben Carter, which a completely different situation, a guy who was falsely accused, and I don't want to sing the song or anything, but I will never understand why Susan Sontag, you know, felt that something was missing because she didn't meet Joey Gallo before he died. I mean, these are not nice people. These are people who, you know, who've done all kinds of horrible things. And they get romanticized, and you know, I'll never understand that part of it. It's just strange. And I wanted to ask you. I asked you before if Joey was crazy. Was he any crazier than anyone else in his line of work? I mean,
well, I think he was more out, you know, flamboyantly crazy. I mean, that was his MO in terms of, well, I'm gonna use this kind of wisecracking, giggling personality to put the fear into my victims. I think that's that was definitely a Joey Gallo trademark. But you know, a lot of these guys are sociopaths and psychopaths in their own way. There's no denying that.
How did Nicky Barnes, how did he feel about Gallo? I mean, many years have passed and. Is he just very straightforward about what Gallo is and was, or, you know, does he speak with fondness of the man?
Oh yes, he definitely speaks with fondness about him. And these guys were, you know, like I said, they were friends of the joint for years. And I think that they, you know, they kind of both fancied themselves, you know, philosophers / gangsters, and you know, in the '60s prison. So you know, they're all up on existential philosophy and everything that's in the vogue in '60s prisons at the times. And in many ways, I think that their characters were a lot like each other. They're both they are both intelligent, and they're both sociopaths as well.
I've got a couple questions from the web chat. They all seem to be coming from the same person. Were there any living members of the Gallo gang that you spoke to, or are they still in the family business?
I'm not going to be able to answer that. That's again some professional distance there.
So you're not saying that you did or did not speak to them, or
correct?
Okay. I'm going to skip some of these other things that he's asking here. I think you answered the basic part of that question. Did Nicky Barnes, would he say that he and Gallo were similar in many ways, or were they very different?
Well, I think that, again, like I said, I think that they shared similar interests, and they both had their own visions of what they wanted to do with organized crime. A guy like Nicky Barnes wants to, take what he's learning, the good things about what he's learning, from being, with the black Muslims, and he wants to twist that to his own ends in terms of building a black mafia to rule the heroin trade. I think Joey's taking a lot of what he's, learning in the coffee shops and reading in Camus and Sartre, and he's twisting it to his own ends to achieve, his own criminal goals. So, I think that they're both, they're definitely both parallel characters, and I think that they definitely, I suppose, studying one illuminates studying the other.
Mm. I don't have this marked in my notes, so correct me if I'm wrong. Was it Nicky that Joey took aside in Attica and explained how organized crime worked, how the setup was from the
Yeah, Joey took Nicky aside, and he this is in Greenhaven State Prison. I think for a guy like Joey, it's only to his benefit if a guy like Nicky Barnes knows how to build his own mafia, because that way you've got an organization and a structure that you can use for the dealing of heroin. And so, I think Joey was definitely using Nicky. Listen, if I get this guy set up, then I can use him, and then we can go out and conquer together, I'd say.
Hmm. Let's come back to Joey's reading. Was there anything in his background and his upbringing, that would lead anyone to expect that this guy would be a reader that would be interested in this stuff? Was Umberto, his father, was he a reader? Was he interested in this stuff?
No, well, I think it's hard to say. I mean, I think like Joey, like a lot of people, he came to Greenwich Village in the early '60s. To kind of escape an upbringing, and his upbringing was very traditional. He was being groomed to be in the mafia. So I think Joey went to the village to seek something different, and there I think he got swept up in this idea of reading as a way of liberation.
Hmm. But it in the end, it really didn't help him, did it?
No, I mean he got gunned down. On the eve of the day after his 43rd birthday, just hours after he was celebrating it, he was gunned down at Umberto's clan house. So, no, that's a bad ending for anyone, I'd say.
And Thomas, we kind of wind down. The caller before mentioned the Gottis, and the sense I think a lot of people have is that their influence has greatly waned with John's passing and his legal troubles and Junior's troubles. Is there even a Gallo presence in New York City in organized crime these days, or is that just all in the past?
That's all in the past.
Yeah, and who is running things?
I'm not sure. I certainly couldn't say. I mean, my focus is historical from the '60s and '70s.
Okay. Well, so you've this is your second. Crime-related book. Let me give out the title of the first one. Of course, that was the Nicky Barnes book, Mr. Untouchable, The Rise, Fall, and Resurrection of Heroin's Teflon Don. And you wrote that with Nicky Barnes, so that had to be an interesting experience.
Absolutely.
And then this one, I don't think I ever gave the full title. It's called The Mad Ones, Crazy Joe Gallo and the Revolution at the Edge of the Underworld. What's next? What do you follow this with?
Well, this is, you know, there's certainly more stories to be, I think, mined from that era of New York City. And I think that crime stories are certainly an interesting way of learning about the social and cultural history of a really exciting time in New York City.
Okay. But, I mean, do you have your sights set on another crime book at this point? Or
we're working on it. I'd rather not talk about the next project at this point, but it's certainly in that same sort of vein.
All right. Well, folks, you can find Tom Folsom's colorful history of the Crooked Gallo Brothers, the Mad Ones, at great bookstores everywhere or online at MrMedia.com or Amazon.com. And you can learn more about Tom's work at his website, www.TomFolsom, that's F-O-L-S-O-M, TomFolsomSolid.com. Tom, it's a very interesting book, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, take care and good luck. And folks, for more crime-related interviews, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversation with Donnie Brasco himself, Joe Pistone, and as well as O.J. Simpson's friend and publicist and documentarian, Norman Pardoe, and Craig Glazer, author of The King of Sting. Please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites, whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, Pointer Online, MySpace, Facebook, NetVibes, Multiply, Zanga, Digital Journal, Friendster, Orkut, Bebo, Tagged, iGoogle, Yahoo, Podcast, Pickle, Vox, Folio, Mediafly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, or Odeo. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. Subscribe to Mr. Media in iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews within the podcast section of iTunes and click the free subscribe button. It's that easy. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. It's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give a piece of your day to spend it with us. Thanks for listening.